good to be back with you again and share some thoughts this evening on a most difficult topic. How do you work with the violence in these texts of the prophets? We've talked about, last evening we talked about the prophet and the call. This morning we worked with the prophet and relationship with God. This afternoon, the prophet and social justice. Tomorrow morning, we work with the prophet in the future. Does the prophet predict the future? How are we to talk about? I won't go there. We got to hear. Trying to get away from the topic for tonight somehow, but we got to get there. Okay. How do you talk about this violence in the prophets and elsewhere, for that matter? But how shall we speak of God's judgment in today's world? Some interpreters of the current world scene are not hesitant at all in the way in which they respond. They point to, say, the depletion of the ozone layer, global warming, unnatural developments in the animal world up our way, it's deformed frogs, the spread of deadly diseases, weather patterns that seem uncommonly violent. Aside from the heightened rhetoric that often accompanies such talk and the, what should we say, the undisciplined certainty, isn't there perhaps a kernel of truth in linking such developments to the judgment of God? Many short-sighted views on divine judgment exist. Stress on individual judgment or spiritual issues or neglecting the socioeconomic, political issues of judgment or the psychical, bodily dimensions of judgment. Generally speaking, the more narrowly we speak of judgment, the more restricted our understanding of salvation will be. If, for example, judgment is only or primarily a spiritual matter, then the healing of the body or the healing of the environment will tend not to be comprehended within our understanding of salvation. The wide range of thinking about about divine judgment in the Bible merits more attention than it's been given. It has too often been left to the extremists. We got to go in there and claim this ground. Let's talk about it. What can we say that's helpful? The metaphor of God as judge is often decisive in thinking through the matter of divine judgment, naturally. At the same time, the metaphor of God as a judge prompts one to think of judgment primarily primarily in forensic terms, as if sort of each judgment were the result of a specific divine decision. Though the language of judgment obviously is associated with the court of law, juridical or courtroom categories don't really sufficiently comprehend the workings of divine judgment. This is true from several perspectives. For one, God's judgment is never simply justice. In terms of straightforward legal thinking, God is much too lenient. God's patient, forbearing, slow to anger, open to changing the divine mind. For another, judgment is understood fundamentally in relational terms. A relationship is at stake here, not an agreement or a contract or a set of rules. I mean, it's interesting that the prophets don't have God bringing judgment in terms of a legal statute with sanctions. They don't cite the law and say, well, you know, these are the effects because that's what it says the effects will be in the law. God does not impose, and this I'll seek to defend, God does not impose anything new on the judgmental situation, but mediates the consequences of sin. From another perspective, Erich Zenger, current German scholar, is helpful in showing that in thinking about God as a judge, quote, "The public system of justice remains only an analog for what is at stake in talk about God. God is not at all a neutral representative of an independent court of justice. Human judges, when they're doing their job well, dispense sentences with dispassionate objectivity." I mean, what would courtrooms be like if judges were constantly displaying their personal anger, anguish in the courtroom? God, on the other hand, is never cool and detached about these things. God has a binding relationship with those at whom the divine anger is directed, and is openly anguished over the possibilities in the situation. Hosea 6:4, I love it. I think it's a parental image. Israel, what am I going to do about you? Personally caught up in the situation, this God is. And so such features of the prophetic portrayal of God as a judge constitute a no in the metaphor that must stand alongside any yes in the metaphor. In other words, the personal dimension of wrath and judgment qualifies any legal or juridical understandings of judgment. Or another, I forget where I learned this, somewhere along the line. I've been living with it for quite a while. But when thinking of God as judge, remember that the judge behind the bench is the spouse of the accused one in the dock. A relational understanding of judgment, very important. Divine judgment is properly understood as the effects of human sin, but the issue was made even more complex by another reality. One characteristic of communal and historical judgment that we find in the biblical material is that no clean distinction is made between the righteous and the wicked. Think of the fall of Jerusalem at the hands of the Babylonians. Nobody, even God, didn't go through all the people in Jerusalem, "Oh, let's put the righteous over here and they can be negatively affected by this judgment, and we'll put the positively affected, put the non-righteous over here." Wine reminds you a little bit, say, if the Allied armies, which moved into Germany in the wake of Hitler's work, were in any way the agents of God in the bombing of German cities, there was not a nice, neat distinction between righteous and wicked. So also in the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians. It's an issue that's raised by Abraham with God over Sodom and Gomorrah. God, are you going to destroy the righteous with the wicked? Well, as it turned out, yeah. More generally, judgment can be a reality for the elect. Listen to Amos 3:2. "You," God speaking, "you only have I known of all the families of the earth." Oh, yeah, we're the elect. Oh, you bet. "Therefore, I will visit all your iniquities upon you." The prophets brought the elect within the operative sphere of judgment. No individual or community was immune from historical judgment. And if we think about this for today, remember, we may escape eschatological judgment, but none of us are guaranteed somehow an escape from historical judgment. Prophetic literature is filled with violent speech and action, both human and divine. But if there were no human violence, there would be no divine violence. I think we can make that claim. A more specific form of human violence, for example, war, including its anticipation, its execution, its aftermath, provides the primary context within which most of the prophetic literature was written. If you were to take the fall of the northern kingdom to Assyria in 722 and all the events before, during, and after that, and take the fall of Jerusalem in 587, events before, during, and after that, you've got most of the prophetic material and most of the violent language associated with God and God's agents. Violence brings violence in its wake. This has been very troubling to biblical commentators, as I've suggested, and for good reason. One need only read the Book of Lamentations and weep over the effects of God's judgment on the people of Jerusalem by the agency of the Babylonians. Chapter 4 says, compassionate women boiled their children so they would have something to eat. Chapter 5, women are raped by the Babylonian armies. Okay. God's judgment is associated with those kinds of effects. And such texts have led to various attempts to sort of shelve this issue. Remarkable. People tend to make a number of moves. Let's spiritualize it. Put on the whole armor of God. We can make that kind of move. Or reduce it to the mysterious ways of God in the world, even though these texts have a remarkably plain sense. Or even cutting these texts out of the Bible. Maybe not actually, but in your lectionaries, you won't find any of them. And this concern about divine violence has intensified in recent years. Maybe it has to do, with several things here. The cumulative violence over the course of the 20th century, the number of people who have been killed over the course of 20th century, non-combat people have been killed. It's just remarkable. More recent experience, 9/11, terrorist activities, spread of interreligious conflict, all of it available to everybody on a daily basis through the media. This is a question that I have heard more in the last 10 years or so in working out and about with people on this question. Is it so that God could have stopped these things, but didn't? I mean, God could have stopped those planes before they headed into the buildings in New York City or the Pentagon, but chose to stand back? It's out there. What are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with those kinds of questions? It's also noted that the increasing realization, I think, that the Bible's violence has played a part in the spread of the world's violence. Altogether too often, the actions of God in the Bible have been voiced as justification for human violence. From the Crusades to 19th century slavery to the denigration of women, it's quite a list. And one may claim that the Bible is not properly used in such situations when that sort of grounding occurs. But at the least, don't we have to all admit that the Bible has not provided safeguards for preventing such interpretations. Some interpreters think that voicing such probing questions about the violence of God is just inappropriate, out of bounds. But such questioning has long been integral to the Judeo-Christian tradition, has deep roots in the biblical texts. You can note the questions raised by Abraham over Sodom and Gomorrah. God, and listen to the sharp language that Abraham brings, will the judge of all the earth do what's just? Abraham, the father of the faith. Moses, over God's threat to kill all those who participated in the worship of the golden calf in Exodus 32. God, what will the neighbors think of you if you do this? An interesting observation on Moses' part. The Egyptians, but neighbors, what will they think if you do this? Now, let me be clear that the prophets and their God do often promote nonviolence. The eschatological reflections of the prophets are marked by visions of peace and nonviolence, and extending even to the animal world. The wolf will dwell with the lamb. You know that material well. And such texts do demonstrate that violence is an intruder in God's world. And some texts do witness that God makes every effort to stop the violence, but God is successfully resisted. God's will is successfully resisted. That people can make choices that successfully resist the will of God, like sinning. For example, in the face of the post 597 BCE Babylonian threat, God calls Jeremiah to bring a word, and it's intended to reduce the violence. And I love this text. You never hear about it, but it's a nice one to remember in Jeremiah 38. I don't know if I can find it. It'll be just right. These pages are sticking together. Jeremiah 38, verses 17 and 18. Jeremiah said to Zedekiah, "Thus says the Lord, the God of hosts, the God of Israel, if you alone..." What's God doing saying if? Why would God ever need to say if? We'll talk more about that tomorrow. "If you will only surrender to the officials of the king of Babylon, then your life will be spared, and the city shall not be burned with fire, and you and your house will live if you do this. But if you don't surrender to the officials of the king of Babylon, then this city shall be handed over to the Chaldeans, and they shall burn it with fire, and you yourself shall not escape from their hand." People can make choices that successfully resist the will of God for the situation. God's will is nonviolence. The future would take a less violent course, God says, if the people decided to do this. And Israel's own use of violence leads to even greater violence. Now, a key factor that must inform considerations of biblical violence is the centrality, again, we come back to relationship for Israelite theological reflection. When thinking about violence, think about relationship. Human sin ripples out and affects the entire creation. The link between human violence and the non-human world is so powerful in the prophets. If you take a look at a text like Hosea 4, 1-3, "He Hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel, for the Lord has an indictment against the inhabitants of the land. There's no faithful. Now, it's almost like Ten Commandments here. There's no faithfulness or loyalty. There's no knowledge of God in the land. Swearing, lying, murder, stealing, adultery, break out, bloodshed follows bloodshed. And all of a sudden, you're expected. Some note, there's no word about what God's going to do here. Just notice what verse 3 says. Given all sinning, therefore, the land mourns. And all who live in it languish, together with the wild animals and the birds of the air, and even the fish of the sea are perishing. Sounds like it's written by some environmentalist who lived last week. Huh? Violence perpetrated anywhere reverberates everywhere, catches even up the non-human side of life in which we live. Because Israel understood its God to be deeply engaged in the affairs of the world, even God is going to be affected by these acts of violence. And the Bible chooses to tell it like it is. If the Bible had been written at the end of the 20th century, it would be a much more violent book than it is. Because the Bible tells it like it is. Now, this understanding of violence in relationship places a key question on the table. What does it mean for God to be a faithful member of this relationship with Israel, and the world for that matter, in the midst of all its violence? Let me make a claim, and it's testing the waters a little bit here, and try to come back to it in a couple ways tonight and tomorrow. We indicated it this morning. God so enters into relationships that God is not the only one with something important to do. And, point two, and is given the power with which to do it. Creatures in relationship with this kind of God have been given genuine power. The first words out of God's mouth to the newly created human beings in Genesis 1 is, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, have dominion, subdue the earth. I'm giving you something to do and the power with which to do it. And God honors this relationship, is unchangeably faithful to this relationship. That here comes my language, challenge it, that God chooses to be self-limiting in the exercise of divine power within a relationship. For the sake of the relationship, God chooses self-limitation. Love always qualifies the use of power. And I'm not somehow claiming that God is sort of other than omnipotent or not omnipotent. I'm not suggesting that at all. The issue has to do with the exercise of omnipotence and the self-limitation that is inherent in any relationship of consequence. And in God's relationship with this world, with Israel, this is a relationship of consequence. So this divine self-limitation, it's God's move, not our move, God's move, this self-limitation, necessary for the freedom of the creatures in the relationship, is a key factor in understanding biblical violence. Israel's long story of successful resistance to God's will for nonviolence has had deep effects on every aspect of life. And this violent reverberating out and about activity of the creatures complicates, indeed, severely complicates God's working possibilities in the world. Because of God's committed relationship to this world, And self-limitation for the sake of the relationship, huh? No resolution will be simple. No quick fix will be available even for God, given God's choices. The enemies of God and land cannot be overcome with the flick of a wrist, the flick of God's wrist. Though how often it is we use that kind of language, that God could just snap the divine fingers and take care of everything. We've got to find a different way to talk about that. One might wish that God would force compliance, get rid of the violence. But because of the genuineness of the relationship that God has, God's efforts to that end will entail constraint and restraint in the use of power. And so these laments will continue to be uttered, and the suffering is going to go on for both God and world. Another issue that becomes important here is that God chooses to work in the world in and through various human and non-human agents to get things done. God acts directly, but always through means. Always through means. Language, people, animals, wind, I mean, take your list. A variety of means is impressive. Okay. Maybe just make quick 5 points here. If not all of the violence associated with God is due to God's decision, let me start that again. Most, if not all, of the violence associated with God in the Bible is due to God's decision to use agents that are capable of violence. And let me try these 5 points. One, quick. God chooses to work in and through non-divine agents to achieve God's purposes for Israel and the world. Whether you're talking about the wind and the waves at the Red Sea, talking about the Babylonian armies, or whether you're talking about the prophets, God works in and through agents. Two, God doesn't perfect human beings or other creatures before deciding to work in and through them. Let's take a moment to look around the room. Okay. God works with what's available, including the institutions of society. Among such institutions in that ancient time were certain ways of waging war, trappings of government, etc., etc. And then this is a sentence that is important for me. Violence will be associated with God's work in the world, come what may, because to a greater or lesser degree, violence is characteristic of the agents in and through whom God's work is done. I mean, I think that's so important, okay? Okay, violence will be associated with God's work in the world. It will be. Count on it. Because to a greater or lesser degree, violence is characteristic of the persons and the institutions in and through which God's work is done. And that such work by the agents will always have mixed results. Always have mixed results. And will be what happens in the wake of the work of the agents will be less positive than what would have happened if God had decided to do everything all by God's self. Three, God does not micromanage the work of the agents. Exercises, the language we've used so far, exercises constraint and restraint in relating to them. And so it may be that the agents will do things that God doesn't want done. One of the best texts here, I'll just quote it off in a hurry here. But look up Zechariah, out of the way place, Zechariah chapter 1, verses 12 to 15, where it talks about the nations of the world and their use of violence and so forth. And God says this now, Zechariah 1:15. I was only a little angry. They made the disaster worse. Look what the Babylon, I wasn't that angry. They made the disaster worse. The agents went out of control. They exceeded the divine mandate. They're not puppets in the hand of God. And God will in turn pass judgment on their excessiveness. And as I mentioned earlier, think of, the carpet bombing of Dresden or other cities. We, the agents of God against Hitlerian evil, exceed the mandate. And God might well say, I wasn't that angry. You made the disaster worse. So God doesn't necessarily confer a positive value, on the work that the agents do. And just think of all the sermons you've heard through the years. 4. Human beings then are now to not have a perfect perception of how they are to serve as God's agents in the world. We're finite. We have limits. Limits of intelligence, limits of strength, limits of savvy. It's important to note that the role of divine agents in the Old Testament is often expressed in terms of the direct speech of God. And what are the... I've just begun to explore this now. One of the interesting distinctions between Old Testament and New Testament is that in the New Testament, direct divine speech is very rare. 4 or 5 times in the whole New Testament. In the Old Testament, it's all over the place. Might that mean that we should understand some of this direct divine speech in the Old Testament in less than literal terms? Might it be hyperbolic? Might it be less than literal in some sense? How do we interpret this violent language? Okay. 5. That God would stoop to become involved in such human cruelties as war and other forms of violence is finally not a matter of despair, but of hope. That God hangs in there. God just doesn't simply give people up to experience the suffer of the violence. Again and again, God takes the side of those who are entrapped in violence and its effects and does so in such a way that God, entering deeply into the life of the world, bears that violence in God's own self. And the sentence I work with needs some work, perhaps a long way. Let me say, suffering is God's chief way of being powerful in the world. Suffering is God's chief way of being powerful in the world. That's not the normal way in which we think about God's power. But then, go to the cross. Oh, suffering is a means of being powerful in the world. God enters deeply into the life of the world in these prophetic materials. Bears the violence, the tears flow down God's face. And in such a way, God does this to bring good into the world. The tears of the people are fully recognized by God. Their desperate situation is named for what it is. God chooses to participate in their messy stories, our messy stories. God's own self takes the road of suffering. And because God takes this violence unto God's own self and bears it, there is a non-violent future available for our world. Now, it's interesting, if you were, a couple more things and I'll quit here. If you were to go through the prophets and just look at the agents that are used, let's take Jeremiah, let's take Babylonia and Nebuchadnezzar. I've got long lists of verbs in Hebrew here now, where God is the subject of violent verbs. Long lists. God will not pity, God will not spare, God will not have compassion, God will destroy, God will scatter, God will strike down. I mean, they're long, long lists of violent verbs with God as the subject. But right alongside that, what you've got to do is note that every single one of those violent verbs, the Babylonians and Nebuchadnezzar are also the subject. You can parallel them. So that the portrayal of God's violent action is conformed to the agents that God uses, to the means in and through which God works in a given situation. So, in some basic sense, God's violence needs to be associated with the agent's violence again. So consideration of God's work through human agents must steer between the ditches of either that God is ensconced in heaven watching the world go by on the one end, or the other one, the micromanaging of the agents. We need to stand between those two ditches. The biblical texts don't always tell you where to stand in the road between those two ditches, or if they tell you to stand in various places on the road between those two ditches, but neither ditch will do. And the texts confess that God will work in and through even violent agents to get God's saving will done in the world. We need to also think a little bit about the moral order of things, that the sins have consequences, that's the nature of the world that God created. And remember this, that the relationship between sin and consequence in the Old Testament, particularly in the prophets, is conceived in intrinsic terms rather than forensic terms. That is to say, the consequences grow out of the deed itself. There's a whole slew of texts we could listen to. Ezekiel 22, Ezekiel now, 22, 31. God says, I've consumed them with the fire of my wrath. And then what immediately follows is this sentence. I have returned their conduct upon their own heads. Oh. Act consequences, moral order is associated with the wrath of God. God sees to the moral order. And you can track this. Ra'ah in Hebrew is a word for evil, wicked deed. It's also a word for the effects of the wicked deed, the disaster that follows in the wake. Avon, a word for iniquity, sin. It's also a word for the effects of sin. Okay? This verbal linkage makes it clear that the judgment that flows into these moments comes out of people's own wickedness, not from some divinely imposed consequence. You reap what you sow. Chickens come home to roost. And there's some idioms there that come awfully close to what the biblical material wants to say. In sum, Israel's sin generates effects in snowballing act consequence. At the same time, God is active in the interplay of sin and sinful actions and their effects. Third parties are used by God as agents in and through which God works judgment. So you get, but our own sin, the sins of our own forebears press in upon us here. But God's hand is in the midst of it all. God's salvific will remains intact in everything. God's gracious concern for our future, a nonviolent future, is always for the best. But in a given situation, the best that God may be able to offer is burning the chaff to fertilize the field for a new crop. So let me quote, end with a quotation from Brueggemann in his Theology of the Old Testament. God's use of violence, inevitable in a violent world, is intended to subvert human violence in order to bring the creation along to a point where violence is no more. He says, it's likely that the violence assigned to Yahweh is to be understood as counterviolence, which functions primarily as a critical principle to undermine and destabilize other violence. So God's violence is not blind or unbridled violence, but purposeful in the service of a non-violent end. Jeremiah 42:10, a text that's rarely, it's a little problematic in translation terms, but let me just use the NRSV. 42, I'm sorry, God says, for the disaster that I brought upon you. What does it mean for God to say, I'm sorry? God somehow, in thinking through and working through the agents that God does, realizes the excessiveness of that they have used in mandate, in carrying out the divine work in the world. So I think finally we say that God is certainly not bereft of resources to act in the midst of violence or in the midst of suffering. But as I've suggested, suffering becomes a vehicle for divine action. God doesn't relate to a violent situation as a mechanic does to a car, seeking to fix it from the outside. God enters deeply into the suffering human situation and works healing from within. And those of us who are Christians understand what that means, because that's exactly what Jesus Christ did. Thank you very much.